you think that Donald Trump has a Twitter problem?
No. Twitter's a... No. Be like, if you play the piano loud in a terrible way, I wouldn't say he's got a piano problem. No, no, it's a... No, I think his problem's up here. You know, it, whatever the means of communicating to people, it's... I just think he's a bad guy.
Hey there, and welcome to another episode of Builders, a podcast from BetaWorks Studios. It's the midterms, so we're going to get real, very real, with former Senator of Nebraska, Bob Kerrey. We are honored to host Bob here at BetaWorks Studios. Studios is our New York clubhouse for builders and anyone else interested in the startup ecosystem. These podcasts are taken from live sessions. Each week, they feature a new and diverse mix of people drawn from our community. Only at BetaWorks Studios will you find founders and the network around founders authentically chatting around subjects that really matter. I'm Leila Oweda, and I'll be your guide. If you want to know more about our club, visit betaworks-studios.com anytime or contact me for a day pass. But listening to these podcasts is a good reflection of life here. One week, we're talking about how to design for blockchain or build experiences in the age of Instagram. And the following week, we're chatting with technology luminaries such as Jaron Lanier on why we should probably all delete our social media accounts. This week, we'll hear from Bob Kerrey, a former Navy SEAL officer, governor, senator, and presidential nominee in 1992. Bob has pretty much seen it all. He has a Medal of Honor, has dated actress Deborah Winger, has one part of his leg amputated, and had a son at age 58. He's no shrinking violet, which is why we loved having him here at Studios, and why we're going to get straight into it. Asking the questions in this episode is Amanda Brown Learman, a veteran of Barack Obama's first presidential campaign, and is the Democratic National Committee's political and organizing director. All right, without further ado, enjoy this episode.
I think one thing that's been really hard to sort of contemplate in the last couple of weeks in the face of Kavanaugh as a young woman, how do you understand the Kavanaugh vote and the sort of theatrics around Dr. Ford's testimony? And if you were a woman, you know, looking onto the theatrics of those conversations, how do you sort of understand that and still find a place to move forward?
Well, all I can do is make an effort to understand. I can't really have enough trouble understanding what it's like to be a 75-year-old white man. So my wife was sexually assaulted when she was in high school, so I'm in touch with that anger. And it erupted. And she was credible. And they told Kavanaugh, if you want to get confirmed, you got to blow her up. You got to blow the Democrats up. And he did. I regret, frankly, that Franken wasn't there because he was on the Judiciary Committee. I think he would have been a very positive force, especially when Lindsey Graham went off and demonstrated why medical marijuana should be legal.
That's a great line.
Look, it central to what Kavanaugh is going to do is chip away at Roe v. Wade. He's going to chip away at individual freedoms that women have. And it's very much connected to evangelical belief. And it's real. And he's not being honest when he said it's not. So with that in play, and then this sexual, and I think, you know, Diane probably could have handled it better than she did. She probably should have said something like this. You know, we all get letters, and we have to decide, are they crazy or are they not? What do I do with it? All right, in the middle of this hearing, I get this letter from a woman who said she was sexually assaulted by Brett Kavanaugh. What do I do? Do I give it credibility? And I, Esho had seen it, and she thought it was credible, and she probably could have handled it slightly better, although it's not easy when you're going up against a single network that's dedicated to trying to win this battle, regardless of what the facts are. So it was difficult for her to do it. It got mashed up. It absolutely got mashed up. Just so you know, at some point, politics gets very practical. I don't know, have you ever seen a series called Brain Dead with Tony Shalhoub? Has anybody ever seen that? I highly recommend it. It is as good a story about what goes on in Washington as anything you'll ever see. First of all, young people run the place. If you go to 535 House and Senate offices and pull at random 100 people, the mean age isn't over 30. They run the place. This is what happens to be a story about a meteorite that lands close to Washington, D.C., and Smithsonian picks it up, puts it in a warehouse, and in the middle of the night it bursts open and tens of thousands of ants, single file, go up into the cherry blossoms. And then they, when everybody's done with their business, they crawl back out single file, go up in the ears of members of Congress, and they destroy that part of the brain that makes them reasonable. Right. So you get the, it happens. You know, the brain gets unreasonable at times. So, I mean, I do think the Democrats were in a very difficult situation. They had to have 51 votes, and they didn't have 51 votes. They, certainly on ideology, they didn't have 51 votes. And so I think that, you know, the, back to one of the other questions that I asked, I think the House still goes Democratic in the midterm. I think it's likely the Republicans are going to pick up a seat or two in the Senate, entirely because there's an awful lot of guys who look exactly like me that don't understand and have no intention to understanding, and they're nervous. The whole At Me Too thing, it happened very fast, and it's a little bit like marriage equality, except who doesn't know somebody is gay anymore? Marriage equality, I think, it happened fast as a consequence of that, but it was breathtaking how fast that went. Because there were an awful lot of people that you and I know well and like who were saying, well, I don't know about marriage. And the next thing you know, the court makes a decision. In Nebraska, we have 93 counties. Only three of them urban counties. Well, my fourth or fifth year in the Senate, a very good friend of mine I went to college with, a football player in Nebraska, he became an evangelical. And, you know, he's got Jesus talking to him through the fillings of his teeth, and Jesus is saying to him that homosexuality is immoral. So he led a statewide effort to amend the Constitution to take away civil rights, all civil rights from gays and lesbians. And he crushed me. It was almost 2-1. When the court made its decision, not a protest in 93 counties. You can go in any county in the state of Nebraska, gay and lesbian, you can get married. You can get a marriage, and there's not a single peep of protest. That one's a little easier to understand because, you know, after all, man, at some point you've got to say, you know, yeah, I'm a farmer. I've been single all my life. I guess maybe I'm gay too. So it's not that hard. But I think the At Me Too thing is more difficult. It's much more difficult. It's harder to settle it out because I'm not sure there's a statutory solution.
Yeah, there's not a process, which I think a lot of the advocates, even in the Kavanaugh fight, sort of understood. It's just like, what is the actual demand what are we actually fighting for beyond, obviously, not having him on the Supreme Court? So I think one of the big lessons learned from the 16 cycle is, we'll have a positive spin here of just like, you need to build a winning coalition to win in an election year. When you think about the rural, I think a lot of people sort of understand the 2016 cycle as we didn't talk to enough rural voters, or we, you know, some, I think depending on sort of what constituency you're coming from, you'd say we didn't talk to enough of them. What do you think makes the winning coalition going into even the midterms that are 18 or 22 days away and then looking ahead to 2020?
There's a great blues song called Nobody Loves You When You're Down and Out. Right? So Hillary wins the election. She's a genius. She loses the election. She should have done more rural outreach. Without Comey, she wins. Without the Russians, she wins. So she lost by 70,000 votes in Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. What it does say to Democrats, and I've talked to a number that are thinking about running, I said, well, that's great. You're going to this, that, and the other. Tell me how you're going to win Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, because nothing else matters. If you can't win those states, I was with actually Bloomberg over the summer. I said, you know, you're not going to win Pennsylvania by talking about tax and big sodas. So you got to have an economic message that explains to people what the hell is going on and what do we need to do to respond to it. Whether it was trade, I mean, Trump's not wrong on trade. Yeah. And he's winning public opinion on trade. He's a jerk about the way he does it. He's a jerk about the way he does everything. But he's winning public opinion in those states. So we've got a relatively tight race, no matter who it is, in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan. So you got to put somebody up that can win those three states. So I don't think there's any serious lesson coming out of 16. I don't think it's likely that the FBI director is going to make it hard for a Democrat to win in 20. And I don't think it's going to be likely the Russians are going to be able to get away with what they did in 16. You know, I'm relatively optimistic, but it's going to be a fight because there's significant differences today on the issues. Yeah.
So I think we're all here also because since it is going to be a fight, we all find hope in young people. And I think one of the narratives that is always pervasive and it's always very annoying as an organizer, even in the space, is that young people don't vote, right? That's the criticism, that they don't engage. Why should we be talking to them? People don't understand how to talk to them. So what's your sort of pushback to that narrative that young people aren't necessarily worth it because they're not going to show up anyways?
Well, it's like paranoia. Sometimes it's a rational response to the facts. So think low turnout amongst young people is a terrible condition of democracy. It's not like you haven't got other things to worry about besides who to vote for in a general election. I mean, I didn't get interested in politics until I was almost 40. So who am I to bitch about young people, you know, worrying about how they're going to pay their student loans, and am I going to get a job, is it going to last forever, et cetera, all the sorts of things that you worry about. You know, so I'm not terribly worried about. I don't know if you saw Tim Egan's column last week in the Times. Again, it's on the millennial boomer situation, which I have more questions up because I'm looking in this room. There's a lot of millennials out here, I think. At least I'd like to know what you guys are thinking about. But he basically said the argument that the millennials lost the 2016 election is wrong. It was the boomers who voted for Trump. You can't blame 16 on the millennials. You know, I don't think. My own view is I think we made a mistake when we lowered the voting age to 18. We probably should have lowered it to 16 so that you have your first voting experience when you're still in high school, as opposed to your first voting experience after you get out of high school. It's sort of like you get in this argument about K through 12, and people say, why do test scores drop off in eighth grade? And I said, well, can you add 8 plus 5? Yeah, it's 13, right? What happened to you when you were 13? Oh, I went through puberty. Were you paying attention to fucking trigonometry when you were going through puberty? I don't think so. So you have these moments, and so you're 18 years old and you're out of high school, you're supposed to be on your own. Now what are you doing? You're not sitting around thinking about who am I going to vote for. You got other things that are on your mind. So I think if we had I think dropping another 2 years would have been good. It was dropped to 18 because of the Vietnam War. I think there's lots that can be done to help young people figure out what they're going to do. My top of my list is, if there's an opportunity to get involved in a campaign, do it. Because, I mean, it's you meet people, you get responsibility way beyond what you normally would. It's fun. Even if you lose, it's fun. So, I mean, I've never done a campaign, and I've won and I'm lost. I've never done one that wasn't enjoyable. From, you know, it's stressful and, you know, all that sort of stuff, but they're pretty great.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. There are a lot of cities, actually, or towns now that you can vote at age 16. Even where I live in Tacoma Park, Maryland, they did lower it to 16 so young people can vote in their local elections, which is another thing that you could do in terms of taking a next step, is to help advocate for that sort of local access and opportunity for 16.
At the local election, nobody's voting. So,
well, yeah, that's...
yeah.
But also, I think the sort of numbers of the denominator there, right, in terms of like being able to sell your power is an interesting construct as well. What do you think is, I think one of the struggles that people have right now is like, how the hell do you talk to young people? It's, you know, the age of fake news, it's the age of Twitter, and unless you say it in under even like 138 characters so that when people retweet you, they can add a comment even, or Insta stories, right? Like, how do you sort of break through? What is the best way to communicate? And then I think this is a two-part question of just like, what should you be communicating? What are the issues that resonate? What are the conversations that you should be wielding with that generation in order to get them engaged and keep them engaged?
Well, I don't know. We have a slight advantage in this area because I left the Senate in 2000 because a woman I met in 1995 actually. It's if you don't like Lawrence O'Donnell, I've got an argument. Lawrence O'Donnell introduced me to my wife. He worked for Moynihan, and Moynihan was my best friend in the Senate. So, and she wanted to have a baby, and I didn't want to have another child in politics. And once I decided, and I had a pretty serious case of comitophobia. I was a pretty good single man for 25 years. So, I mean, it wasn't a question of if. She had sperm donors lined up from New York to L.A. So the only question was who's going to be the father. So once I decided to leave the Senate, and she got pregnant shortly thereafter. So we have a 17-year-old. So I have a window into 17-year-old boys and girls. And it's confusing.
Great focus group.
Well, it's a great focus group. But, I mean, the most confusing part is sex. I mean, their attitude towards sex is radically different than mine when I was 17. You know, it was...
Tell us more.
Well, it's... they're experimenting. They're under no pressure to say I'm heterosexual. They can say I'm bisexual, asexual. I'm they. I'm whatever. There's a whole bunch of categories that can't even remember. But they're having very open conversations that way. It's not that it's dangerous at all. I mean, you still have the question: are you going to have unprotected or protected sex? So, but it's a new world. It really is it's a new world. I think it's happened fast. Now, I don't know how distributed it is. We had a bunch of Nebraskans in the other night for a dinner who were trying to build a center for pancreatic research because I've had a number of friends who've been killed by the disease. And including, by the way, Harry Reid has got it right now. I spoke with Harry today. So we're doing this thing, and that's the question I put to them. Are the kids out in Nebraska, do they feel at liberty to talk about experimenting with their sexuality? And the answer from all these people who are no younger than, I'd say, 55, they haven't the foggiest. So my guess is, even in Nebraska, those conversations are going on because I don't have to sit around and wait for somebody to broadcast it to me. It's all, you know, and it's very disconcerting because it's not my reference. It's fun, yeah. So, but it's different. So my guess is, it's how do I pay off my student debt? How do I get a job? How do I start a family? All the usual things that are going on. It's just that the usual things have gotten more expensive. So when I got out of high school in 61, you know, 2/3 of my class got a job. And it was 20 years before I was making as much money as they were. And the job had health insurance, it had pension, and it had post-employment health insurance and pensions, and that was the rule. And you know, if you wanted to, you could stay there 40 years and you know, you had a good living. Those jobs are not entirely gone, but boy, they're pretty nearly disappeared. And that creates anxiety. Yeah. And every single thing going on in the world, I mean, you probably have all been watching this case of you know, the Saudi Arabians. This guy, goes to their consulate in Istanbul, and he gets chopped up and sawed up and thrown into suitcases and hauled out. It feels like he's right down the street. And everything that happens in the world today, it's up front and personal, and it tends to increase the anxiety that you feel. And you know, so my guess is, you know, young people are probably have more anxiety than I did when I got out of high school. All I had was a Vietnam War.
Motivating. How would you sell voting, or how would you sell civic engagement to that 17-year-old that's thinking about all of these other things then? How do you get them to sort of connect those other things that are weighing on them too?
I don't know that I sell. I mean, somebody asked a question about the Hispanic vote. I'm more concerned about that, frankly, than I am the youth vote. At some point you believe that it's fun. And you'll find something that turns you on, and you do it, and you know you don't need to rush it. I certainly would advise you to register and to vote, because I think, you know, although it is a little difficult in New York, you wonder if your vote's worthwhile in New York.
I got a very good
friend who's more liberal than I am. He registers Republican. He says because the lines are shorter. But I think it matters. I just genuinely do. And among the things that I find. Because although I have not, I've been relatively mild here this evening, I engage pretty vociferously in debates. And oftentimes my wife gets upset with me. I said, I'll have to actually explicitly say, if you're a person who cries easily, you may not want to get in an argument with me about an issue where you view the world differently than I. Because I think it's worthwhile engaging as forcefully as possible. And I don't think, I'm not, the president used to say, can't we agree without being disagreeable? And the answer is no. From time to time, we're disagreeable. But you don't have to worry about Aaron Burr hauling you over to Weehawken and shooting you. You know, so it's in 1970, there were 2,000 bombings in America, with 25 people killed, same number in 71. People were dying on both sides of the civil rights debate, both sides of the Vietnam War debate. So it's not worse than it's ever been. Anytime you hear somebody say, oh, it's worse than it's ever been, you say, it's not worse than it's ever been. Exhibit A, 700,000 men died because we couldn't resolve the issue of slavery. We've had a lot worse times than we're having right now.
How do you think the times are different if they're not worse?
Oh, it's massively global. For openers, you can't ignore it. It's global. And, you know, a little speed bump someplace will cause a problem here in the United States and vice versa. I mean, Trump's tariffs are going to come back to bite him. It's not bilateral. It's not, I'm going to punish you and you're going to punish me and we're going to work out an agreement, because it spreads. Because the supply chains are global and you can't change that, I don't think. I mean, I personally don't think it's changeable. But I do think all facts in show that we've made tremendous progress over the course of my life. I mean, you present yourself with diseases today and you're much more apt to get a cure and be able to get treatment if you can afford it. and I stipulate my 17-year-old, the deductible, inflation adjusted, was greater than the total cost of my earlier kids who were born in 74 and 76. I didn't have to be insured to have a baby in 74 and 76. I paid cash. It was an uninsurable event. It can put you in serious trouble. You pray for normal vaginal delivery. So it's gotten better. We're solving problems we never thought we'd be able to solve. There are many that we aren't. I mean, we are. I think Trump's worst legacy is going to be climate. He's turned around on it. I mean, the President Obama went as far as he possibly could have gone, but even he didn't get us to much better on a good day of a 1.5 degrees Celsius increase. And Trump's got us on track to be 2, and that's a big change. So we still have, there's plenty of problems we haven't solved, but it's, I would say, more reason to be optimistic today than it was in 1961, 71, 81, almost any point in time in the past.
Do you think that Donald Trump has a Twitter problem?
No. Twitter's a, no. It'd be like if you play the piano loud in a terrible way, I wouldn't say he's got a piano problem. So, no, it's a, no, I think his problem's up here. Whatever the means of communicating to people, it's, I just think he's a bad guy. If you look at the speech that Eisenhower gave in 1957, that's what a president ought to do. Take something that's unpopular and explain it to people. This is what we have to do. We're a law-abiding nation. And Trump always does the opposite. He could easily, imagine if he'd have said, I've been watching these hearings with Kavanaugh and this sexual harassment thing is a problem. But it isn't a scary time for boys. That's what he said. And women are all right. They are. It's not a scary time for boys. Sexual harassment, sexual assault is a real problem. But he doesn't address it. He doesn't try to explain it because he thinks he can get political advantage going the other direction. I mean, in my lifetime, I have never heard a political figure lie as much as this guy lies. Yeah. You think, okay, I mean, I'm not a purist on lying. I'd say 10% of what I said this evening is not true. So, when you just over and over and over do it, you drop the bar down. His chairman, the Joint Chief, Joe Dunford, is a terrific human being. And he's got this motto. He said, if you walk by something, it's substandard, you do nothing about it, that's a new standard. That's become your standard. And he's lowered the bar. He's lowered the bar for political standards. And when people say, well, all politicians lie, not like this. All politicians insult other human beings, not like this. I don't know if you followed Elizabeth Warren, had her DNA checked out and put out, and I'm going to call her tomorrow. I don't know her. I've only met her once in an airport. So I'm going to call her and say, what you got to do, so you just put out a technical document that shows that 6 generations back, you're Native American, none of that had an impact on whether you got into Harvard. I want to see the x-ray on his bone spurs. Because by the way, if you don't know about bone spurs, I know about bone spurs. They don't go away. Unless there's some, God intervenes and you had a miracle on your hands, they don't go away. So if he had bone spurs in 68 that got him out of going to Vietnam, they're still there. And I bet he does not have bone spurs. So he's got this tendency to do what you see. I think he acquired an All-Star Wrestling. Raise your hand if you ever watched All-Star Wrestling. Yeah, so So you, if for the three of us, four of us now who've watched All-Star Wrestling, who have watched All-Star, the basic rule is the villain always makes it to the finals. The audience loves the villain. And the villain insults, and the villain does bad things, and the villain, makes everybody, all the smart guys feel bad, and the audience say, yeah, that's great, he's a villain. And I think that's what Trump has become. And I don't find it amusing. Every now and then, maybe I'd watch All-Star Wrestling, but I do not want to have my president doing that.
Sure. How do you think that if you were a Republican candidate running right now, how do you think you sort of understand the Trump dynamic or sort of counter the Trump dynamic while you're campaigning? How do you address the fact that he is our president?
Yeah, well, the best way to answer that,
yeah,
you find yourself in a situation where when President Obama was president, if you criticize President Obama, I find myself being accused of being a racist by Democratic supporters of President Obama. And I think there's a fair amount of that with Trump. I'm going to defend my guy. He's one of us. He's my president. I'm going to defend him. And particularly when
Kanye West style right there.
Oh, but Kanye, he's a great artist, but he's a raving lunatic. So,
He's pledged his loyalty.
Whoa, yeah, yeah. See how long that lasts. He doesn't vote?
Thank God.
By the way, completely unrelated. Has anybody in here seen A Star Is Born?
Yeah.
Whoa, is she spectacular? I mean, I've listened to her music before. I had no idea how talented she was. She has got a voice. Lady Gaga, I'm talking about. I don't know what that has to do with.
Also a Democrat.
So I think there's a little of that. I think it's important to try to win over. I mean, I've got lots of friends in Nebraska, in rural Nebraska, who love Trump. And I sometimes am on my unreasonable moments. I say, well, you people in the city don't understand. But I said, you know, I get Tom. That's not the problem. I do understand you. I just don't like it. Your problem is you don't understand me. You don't understand how we organize the city. It's multicultural. That's who we are. So my favorite conversation was a woman had a feedlot out in Nebraska, and she said, well, you don't understand. So Shirley, where are your kids? Are they living you there in Oakland anymore? No, two are in New York and two are in San Francisco. I said, well, why, Shirley, why? Well, there's no job opportunity. No, it isn't job opportunity, Shirley. It's a culture. It's your attitude. It's stifling. And it is. And it's hard. It's not an easy thing to do. I just finished rereading it. Raise your hand if you ever heard of Willa Cather. I just reread My Antonia, and it's a very important book. This is the 100th anniversary of her writing that in 1918. But it's about immigrants, you know, and it's about Bohemians and Swedes and Norwegians. When you think, well, they couldn't have had any trouble. Well, they had trouble. If you look at Nebraska, I said to my rural friends in Nebraska, the rational solution to the fact that 90 out of 93 counties have population declines is to say, we're going to go down to Mexico and recruit as many people as we possibly can to get to come to Nebraska. We got room for at least 500,000. And we have half the population of Brooklyn and the whole darn state. So we got plenty of room. And, Mexicans? Yeah, well, let's see. Let me tell you about them. They work really hard. They save their money. They hang together as a family. They go to church on Sunday. I guess maybe that's become un-American. I don't know. But they are violently against doing something like that. They think their culture is at risk, and it's probably always been thus, and probably always will be. My own solution to it is you got to beat them, and hopefully we beat them with somebody sufficiently respectful that can tell them that we don't hate them.
What do you, how would you sort of think about the next 2 years and the slog that we will be on through this presidential cycle? If you were somebody that was, you know, this was your first time maybe voting, let's say, what should you be looking for in a candidate? What do you think is a winning quality?
Well, I mean, I stipulate again, don't feel badly if that doesn't happen. You know, you got plenty of time. You know, it doesn't have to. I didn't have to overcome you in a hurry. So I'd find somebody you really like and you believe in and you want to help become president of the United States. So, you know, don't screw up your family. Don't screw up your job. Don't ruin your life in the cause. But because there'll be plenty of them. I mean, there'll be double-digit number of Democrats running for the nomination. I think there's only one Republican going to run. There's some talk about Kasich and others, but I think to your earlier question, I don't think there's any room at all. Trump has taken over the Republican Party. He is the Republican Party today. Say what you want. I mean, his MAGA events are pretty spectacular. Scary, but it's spectacular. So I think it's going to be an interesting time. What's that?
Because hate is not an innovation.
Oh, no. Hate's old.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's not new at all. There's nothing innovative about, but
it's a spectacle.
It's a spectacle, yeah. And he's got it, he's got it down. You know, do a little of this, a little of that, a little of this, and, you know, it's all, he plays the favorites out to the audience. You know, I think it's really bad to have a president who's constantly saying, you can't trust the news. You can't trust the government. You know, he's attacking the foundation of the country in both the press and the Constitution. I'd be shocked if you gave him a naturalization examination that he could pass. But it's not good. So yeah, I just find somebody to like and, you know, stand by to lose, and then, you know, work with whoever wins the general, and, you know, find somebody at the local level, maybe be a candidate yourself. I don't know. Just, you know, learn as much history as you can and have as much fun while you're doing it. And, you know, you never know. You, and I give you a long list, actually, of men and women who have met in campaigns and fallen in love, gotten married, and best friends forever. So it's worth doing.
It's true. We can open it up for some questions.
Thank you. The projections that by 2040, or about 20 years from now, about 70% of the population is going to live in 15 states. So how do you think about that as it pertains to, you know, longer term voting trends and equilibrium between parties?
Well, it really does call into question the Electoral College. You know, Trump lost the popular vote and won the Electoral College. Bush lost the popular vote and won the Electoral College. So, and we have 4 out of 9 Supreme Court justices who were nominated by people who didn't win the popular vote. And I think it's only going to get worse. It was probably a reasonable thing to do back in the day when they didn't trust democracy as much as I think the safeguards against public opinion becoming dangerous. And it is public opinion can be a dangerous force, especially uninformed public opinion, which is, there's a lot of that going around. I don't know how you're going to be able to say we really have good representation if we continue to see growth in the urban area and decline in relative population in the rural areas. And that's where we're headed. And we're already there. I mean, I actually pressed the numbers to see how bad it is now, but my guess is it's worse than it was in 20, will be worse than 16, and 20, it's only going to get worse. So long as, you know, somehow they figure out how to get the subways fixed here.
Related question, I guess. Technology, at least in the form of social media, seems, if anything, to be reinforcing tribalism and people separating into their bubbles. I guess I just wonder if you see any hope for bridging that urban-rural divide. You know, will there be Democratic senators from Nebraska in the future, or is that over?
Well, if the economy turns down, Republicans love Democrats when the economy's bad, so I don't view technology as anything other than a means to an end. Certainly better than, I mean, the access that I've got to information today is vastly better than, you know, what I had 20 years ago, even 10 years ago. I gave a good example just a few minutes ago when, you know, I recommend go to YouTube and see Eisenhower give a speech in 1957. I couldn't do that 10 years ago. Now, it's also true, I mean, I was elected governor when I was 39. Started dating an actress by the name of Deborah Winger that year. And we used to, on the weekends after my work was done, we'd walk down to a bar called the Zoo Bar, and they had blues music, and we'd sit at the bar and drink Jack Daniels and dance. And today, I'd be all over, you know, I'd be all over social media. I'd probably have to stay home and not have any fun. So, there's no question that things can get distorted faster. But a lot of that has to do with a shift in power. In 2000, if you're running a campaign in 2000, just to pick a safe point in time, it's probably true in 2004 even, but 2000 definitely. Let's say I'm running against you, and we find out that you gave a speech in one group and you're saying you're for a woman's right to choose, and another group you said, I'm going to make sure abortion is illegal, trying to win both groups, and we've got a tape recording if you do it. In order for me to get the public to know that, I've got to go to the bars where the journalists are hanging out and persuade one of them to run a story on it. Because I've got, you know, two newspapers that are important. I've got 3 or 4 radio stations that were, in those days, were still broadcasting and had actual reporters. And that's it. I got a couple television stations that are doing stuff. I have to persuade them. Not anymore. But I went back out to Nebraska and ran in 2012. It was startling. The first question I got was, you know, there's a website, anti-Bob website, and it said the following: would you respond to this question? I said, who the hell are they? This is the senior political reporter for the statewide newspaper asking me a question that she saw on a website because she Googled it. So there is a tendency to think, well, God, this is horrible, then we're all going to organize in tribes. But I don't think in and of itself a tribe is a bad thing. I'm now a managing director for a little merchant bank here in New York City called Allen & Company. And when they hired me, they said, well, we got a rule, you eat what you kill. Said, really? Well, first of all, I said, you guys ever kill anything? Because it's unpleasant. But leaving that aside, who are we killing? Are we killing our customers? Who's the op? And by the way, we didn't survive as a species by eating what we kill. We survived as a species by organizing in tribes. So by itself, tribes by itself aren't bad. It's just when the tribes believe that the others, there's something wrong with the others, when the tribes can't embrace another tribe. That's where it gets dangerous, as far as I'm concerned. And we got a fair amount of that today. And I do think Trump encourages it. He encourages disunity. And be clear, he could win a second term as a consequence.
I have one question. So you've spoken about Trump. You think he's a not good guy. One thing, he's definitely not as modest. And I'd be curious from your perspective now, you've had a little bit of time where may not be held accountable, but what is one thing that you would look back on as a political decision you made with regret and that you would do different, or that you would do differently now, and why?
You know, I don't know. There's enough time in the evening to, here's the thing. I'm just going to talk about the Senate, not about as governor. The opportunities that I missed when I was governor were just born of ignorance. I mean, I had never run for office before. So, if you asked me in 1983, why am I a Democrat, I don't know. I was dating a woman who took me to a Democratic event, I guess. I don't know. I really hadn't thought it through. You know, I was injured in a war, and I got a claim on all your incomes as a consequence of a law that gives me that claim. And so when I hear people say government's a problem, and government's a solution, the Republicans, at that time it was President Reagan, the government's the problem, and the Democrats were saying the government's the solution. In my lifetime, the government was a solution. So I tended to orient that way. So as governor, most of the mistakes I made were just, I was stupid. I didn't know what I was doing. So, I'm exaggerating for effect. In the Senate, on the other hand, if you're thinking about running for senator or governor, the reason the governor job is cool, because first of all, you're home all the time. You're not flying back and forth, which can be very, very disorienting. You tend to, when you're away from home, do things you shouldn't do, and you see it all the time. It's not widespread in Congress, but it can be a problem because you're living in a apartment like you were in college. And you get up in the morning and you go for, in my case, I go for a run, I come back home, I take a shower, I have breakfast, I get in the car, I'm still soaking wet, and I drive down to the office, I get in the office and I got an inbox that's stacked to the ceiling and I'm trying to catch up and I got meetings that start at 8:30 or whatever, and you just get drugged along in the dump current all day long. And so as governor, you can say, somebody says to you, well, governor, there's a piece of legislation moving your way that's going to increase taxes and for education. How do you feel about that bill? And I'd say, well, it's an interesting bill. I'm really studying that really, really hard. In the Senate, you can't say that. In the Senate, at some point, you go down and vote, and it is binary. There's no maybes. It's vote yes, vote no. And I'd say if I cast over 12 years, let's say I cast 3,000 votes, I'll bet you no fewer than 2,500 of them were close to unanimous, and there was no doubt. Or I vote, maybe it's not unanimous, but I am extremely confident I cast the right vote. But some of them are not. War powers resolution, it's quite common not to know for certain. I wasn't there when the Iraq War was done. I think I probably would have voted in the affirmative, and that would be on my list of regrets. But yeah, there are votes that I regret that I think if I did it again, I would do it differently. But you're never sure. So, in the last couple of weeks, a question has come to me: would you vote for Kavanaugh? Would you vote for Gorsuch? And I say I don't think so. And here's why: I think if I was there, I would vote no. And here's why: it's an ideological vote. But you never know when you're down there. When I was governor, there's a really, really close friend of mine who's the head of the AFL in Nebraska. And he always wanted to be in the legislature. And sure enough, the guy that was holding the seat in his district died. And I called Gordy and I said, I'm going to appoint you. And he was there in the first session. He came into my office. He was sobbing. I can't do it. No matter what I do in a controversial vote, half the audience loves me and half of them hate me. And you know, getting enemies mad at you is easy, but getting friends mad at you? I mean, I voted for NAFTA, and I think it was the right vote, but I've got friends who won't speak to me anymore. I voted for the 93 budget, and I got friends that won't speak to me anymore. So it does, you know, there are these moments when you say, okay, it's going to change your life regardless of whether you did the right thing or not. I think probably the biggest one of all, I mean, we've known we're putting too much carbon in the atmosphere all the way back into the 1990s, and we didn't respond. I think if you look at, there's a terrific movie, a documentary on Moynihan. It's called Moynihan. It's shown at the Film Forum. And we haven't done enough on race. And that was what Moynihan was trying to do. We don't spend enough on, I voted against the repeal of the welfare reform that President Clinton pushed hard. But, you know, a lot of the income inequality we have right today began in the 1990s or before. So, I mean, I regret that he didn't push harder on those areas.
So it's been really interesting hearing about, you know, this discussion around ideologies and tribalism. And I think kind of folding into that as a relatively young, like an old young person, one thing that is
millennial.
Yeah. The scariest thing to me is the almost radicalization or extremism that's happening more and more in politics, where it's like two sports teams rather than people, right? So one thing that used to be on the sidelines, like in the far reaches of the internet, were all these conspiracy theories, you know, as one example. And now you hear senators talking about paid protesters, George Soros conspiracy. And that, I think that's been really scary to me personally. And it makes me feel pretty hopeless about politics that, you know, one great thing about Obama is he at least tried to reach across the aisle and bring people together. Or, you know, Beto O'Rourke nowadays is kind of trying to do a similar thing. But very few politicians that I can think of, especially Republican politicians, but very few in general are trying to do that, as opposed to just try to find the majority and, you know, work with the party rather than for the people. So I'm just wondering, is there anything we can do to counteract that, or what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, you've identified one real problem with social media, because you're quite right. In the old days, not only was it difficult to get a story in, but some of the stories shouldn't be there at all. I mean, I was on the 9/11 commission, and I can tell you the number of people come up and said, hey, the Jews did it. You know the Jews did it. You know it was an inside job. Go look at this website, and there's like six videos of somebody making the case that buildings couldn't possibly have been knocked down by airplanes. I indicated earlier, Moynihan was a friend. Moynihan had a passion for lots of things. One of them was, we have too much secrecy. And I agree with him. We have way too much secrecy in the government. Because oftentimes, and that's what 9/11 proved, secrecy sometimes produces more insecurity, not less. So he did a panel up here in New York at the Graduate Center, CUNY Graduate Center. And it was me and Arthur Schlesinger and a couple of really smart guys. Now, this is not, I did never call myself a really smart guy. So he wants me on the panel, and we did the panel. And first question, this woman went right at Schlesinger. You know who killed Kennedy, and it's in your files in your home. And it went downhill from there. I mean, the Chinese are putting messages on our milk cartons, and I thought, whoa, this is New York and the Graduate Center. So it's gotten a lot easier to, especially when you got a president. I mean, Obama wasn't immune from it. I mean, Trump, playing the villain, won the Republican primary by leading the birther movement. There was absolutely no evidence. It didn't matter. If you look at some of the things he said, this is what he said. Well, so now, President Trump, do you think immunizing a child will produce autism? Well, you know, I've talked to a number, it's rhetorical language. He said, well, I've talked to some people who said they got a vaccine and then their child got autism. I've heard that, yeah. Do you think 9/11 is an inside job? Well, no, but you know, there's some evidence that there, you know, that's the way they play it. And no question, that he blows a dog whistle to that crowd. And some of that crowd are nasty, white supremacists, racists, and you know, anti-Semites, and I know them. When I got elected in 83, we had a big problem with the economy. The farm economy was in terrible shape, and the Posse Comitatus in the Aryan Nation were on the rise. I mean, seriously on the rise, and I know those guys. And I, you know, the Federal Reserve's the enemy, and when he went after the Federal Reserve, they're all saying, yeah, he's gonna go get the Federal Reserve, and they think the Federal Reserve's run by, you know, basically the guys at the protocols of the elders. I mean, he really, so I do think that conspiracy stuff is a problem, because it's a lot easier to organize around it, a lot easier to broadcast it and get people to believe it. And especially people that, you know, what are they doing? They're on Facebook all day long, and they're on Instagram all day long, and they're, whatever's coming through, they tend to believe it. Because it's, you know, it takes a little bit of effort to push through those things and try to find out, is it really true? So, yeah, I think that is a problem.
But I think that's a great point, that idea of transparency in government, and the more transparent we are, maybe the more,
yeah,
the more power
that. Yeah, but I don't think it's hopeless. You know, I mean, women couldn't vote till 1920. African Americans got the vote in 1865, but they really couldn't vote till 1965. And we're going backwards on that today. If you look at what's going on in Georgia, the candidate for governor down there is a secretary of the state, and he's tied up 50,000 black votes 3 weeks away from the election. So, yeah, I don't think there's cause to feel like it's hopeless. But if you expect perfection, then all hope is lost. There's two words that often get thrown around a lot without a lot of examination. One is skepticism, and the other is cynicism. And I think it's reasonable, I think it's necessary to be a skeptic. Because a skeptic merely says, prove it up. Show me the facts. Let me do the analysis myself. And then I'll either agree or I won't agree with you. And if I agree with you, fine. If I don't agree with you, that I'll tell you so. But I'm going to be skeptical that what you're saying isn't necessarily true, and I'll do an examination. Cynicism occurs typically later in life. You don't find very old millennials who, and I would urge you to avoid taking that step, because the cynic says other human beings aren't capable of doing good. Human beings are not capable of doing it. That's what the cynic believes, and they're wrong. And what happens in life, a few of you have experienced it, but what happens in, this is a crude and a way of describing life, but it's kind of how I believe. You're born, you die, and everything in between is a series of loss. So, and the question is, what do you do? How do you adjust to loss? Things go bad in your life. Your mom dies, your dad dies, a friend dies, I mean, your husband dies, your wife, I mean, you have losses in life. You support somebody and they turn out to be corrupt. You lose your naivete, you lose your innocence. And what do you do? And I think it's good to be a skeptic and bad to be a cynic. Because once you cross that cynic, become a cynic, it's like a virus. And you start to infect people that you like. And all of a sudden, your life is miserable. There's a terrific book called Man's Search for Meaning. Blank on the author's name. Viktor Frankl. He's a Viennese psychiatrist. He goes to Auschwitz. And to simplify a complicated, lovely story is that they took everything away, everything that he valued. But the one thing they couldn't take away was his attitude. And it's the only thing that determines whether or not you're going to survive.
All right, everyone, so that was Bob Carey. Hopefully you're now motivated to vote, join a party, or even run for office yourself. If you'd like to spend some time with us here at Studios, check out all of our membership details at betaworks-studios.com. As we grow the Builder community, we'll still be holding many public events, like this one with Bob, but the best stuff tends to happen during the day, between members, all sharing ideas, and making stuff happen. So just like Bob, we have an incredibly diverse range of interests. Take a look at all of the past episodes on our page at betaworks-studios.com/stories. There, you'll find sessions on future tech for brands, designing for blockchain, and why you should delete your social media accounts. Here's a little snippet from that episode with Jaron Lanier. Seems pretty appropriate after today's discussion.
Mankind has real problems to face.
Yeah.
And if we can't face them with collective sanity, we will die. So I view this as an existential issue.
Assuming we don't all die. If you'd like a day pass to come hang out at studios, just let me know. I can be found on Twitter at Leila Ueda, but also feel free to just click on the description box for my info and all the ways to reach me. So for more episodes of Builders, just subscribe on Apple or wherever you choose to listen. Check back with us every Tuesday for new episodes. And if you leave us a review in iTunes, that would help so many more people find all of this great knowledge. Follow along with us on social media. We can be found on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at BuildersPod, hashtag BuildersPodcast for all things Builders. If you click on the description box, it's all linked there. We look forward to hearing from you. And until next time, I'm Leila Ueda. Happy building from all of us at the BetaWorks Studios team.